You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds. This is your murder mystery world tour. And this week we are continuing Herds. No crime in the mountains.
No crime? There's been at least two. At least two. Probably more. Probably a lot more, actually.
I mean, you could argue the case that there has been a lot of crime in these mountains.
A lot of crime.
But really, it's more, you know, the kind of... If a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, dealio.
Well, you know what? It's a good thing Evans is here to hear the crime. In fact, be a part of the crime. Dude gets assaulted. Dude is, like, nearly murdered several times.
Oh, it's always good when your detective actually ends up in physical danger. Sometimes the armchair gets a bit dry.
Yeah, sometimes the armchair gets a bit dry. You know what? You're right. Sometimes we gotta put the fear of death in our detectives. And that's certainly where Evans is right now, at the end of chapter 9 of No Crime in the Mountains, speeding away along the highway.
Yes. Well, chapters 5 to 9 today. Herds is the blind man. He has to solve this.
Yeah.
Before we get into the story, though, Herds.
Yeah.
I have something that I've been doing. This book so far.
I hope you've been doing something, Flex, to prepare for the show. What have you got for me right now? What are you doing?
So,
you surprised me with something.
Have you heard
I'm
of
scared.
This thing called foreshadowing?
Yes.
So, you know those rules by Ronald Knox and S.S. Van Dyne that we always speak about, but particularly at length, I think, with this book.
I'm vaguely familiar with them. I hear you can catch them on the website and on the podcast if you want to hear us speak more about them. But yeah, tell me, Flex.
So, I have to say... that there are actually more rules that we need to talk about.
More?
And Raymond Chandler wrote them.
There's already too many rules. Why is he writing more rules? What is this?
I've been committing foreshadowing to lay waste to your ears with all of these rules as we get forwards to Raymond Chandler's rules for detective fiction.
I don't like this.
And I've got to say, Herds, I think you will like Raymond Chandler's rules.
All right. Do you have a list? How many are there?
I do have a list, but I want you, first of all, to try have a guess at what those rules would be. You know, we have the Knox and Van Dyne rules. Some are about fair play. Some are about how to write a good novel. Where do you think Raymond Chandler lies?
That is an excellent question. I mean, I feel like he's less focused on the puzzle. That's certainly something that I'm getting the vibe on. Look, I don't even know if I'm meant to figure out who killed who. I don't know if that's the thing. Less about the puzzle, more about, like, the story and, like, how much sense it makes. I don't know.
You're getting there. You're pretty all right. I will tell you before we get to this list, though, that the two related links at the bottom of this article on Thrilling Detective, which is an excellent source for detective fiction-y type stuff online... The two articles linked at the bottom are titled Lighten Up, Ray, and Raymond Chandler was an asshole.
Wow. So there's some controversy around Raymond Chandler,
isn't
there?
We'll get to that.
Oh my goodness. We're going to live react to some controversy.
I have so much. This might be entire first segment. We'll see how
long I'm okay with that. Here we go.
Let's go down these 10 rules quickly.
Let's go through it.
Just some highlights. The first, the novel must be credibly motivated. The methods of murder, this is the second rule, the methods of murder must be technically sound.
Okay.
The third,
sure.
It must be realistic in character, setting, and atmosphere.
Okay.
Four, it must have a sound story value apart from the mystery element.
Okay.
Five, it must have enough essential simplicity to be explained easily when the time comes. Six, it must baffle a reasonably intelligent reader.
Uh-huh.
Seven, the solution must seem inevitable once revealed. Eight, it must not try to do everything at once. And nine, it must punish the criminal in one way or another, not necessarily by operation of the law. And finally, it must be honest with the reader.
Okay. These are fine, I suppose. They're definitely not as focused on fair play, which is exciting. It's very
different. Normally we would do an episode, you know, aside from our main show on the podcast with these, but I don't really have much to say about these.
They're pretty straightforward.
It's pretty straightforward, pretty good, you know, advice for just general storytelling in general. You know, it should have something to weigh it up behind the core element. I think that's just good writing advice.
Mm.
These all seem pretty reasonable, right? It's good advice. It goes over some good details of the story. If a detective novel had all of these, I would say it is probably a good story.
It's pretty reasonable. Yeah, for sure.
Now, on the other hand,
uh-huh.
Raymond Chandler's On the Simple Art of Murder.
What is this? Is this a novel that he's written about how terrible murder mystery is?
It is an essay that he wrote on murder mystery fiction and detective fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I I wished I could resurrect the man to punch him in the face.
What?
Having read
What has this man done?
Can we, I will go down the highlights, which admittedly also picked from the Thrilling Detective website because they did a very good job
That's right. They're a good source of information. I like it.
On the classics in detective fiction, he says, there are no classics of crime detection.
Okay.
Not one. Within its frame of reference, which is the only way it should be judged, a classic is a piece of writing which exhausts the possibilities of its form and can hardly be surpassed. No story or novel of mystery has done that yet.
Is he trying to challenge...
close.
Is he trying to challenge Van Dyne for most pretentious murder mystery writer?
He is absolutely... 100%.
He stepped up to the podium. He's had a swing.
Because I read these articles in this order. I went, oh, here's the 10 rules.
That's
click
fine.
Through to the next one.
This
oh,
is just
here's
getting...
what he said. What? He said what?
He seems like a lovely man. So that's just the first point. How many points are there?
There's a few.
There's a few. Okay. What's the next one?
The next one is probably my favorite.
Okay.
On quality.
Favorite?
The average detective story is probably no worse than the average novel.
Okay.
But you never see the average novel published.
Wow. Whoa. Raymond Chandler, what are you doing? This man does not like murder mystery. That's what I'm hearing.
What is happening?
He is not a fan of the genre that he writes in. What is happening here?
Ugh.
Raymond Chandler, why would you say these things?
I told you, Herds. I told you before the show that
why
I was going
this
to spring
novels?
Something on you. Do you understand now why I needed to have you react to this in real time?
What is happening? Why are we covering this man's novels? He doesn't deserve the time of day. He doesn't deserve me. Why is he on this program? What is happening? Flex? Why did you pick this novel?
Because it's a good story. And
you're not
this
wrong.
Is the funniest article about detective fiction I've read since Van Dyne.
Oh my goodness. You're right. We did need another Van Dyne. That's what I said
I
left those episodes. Was we need another controversial murder mystery writer. There's going to be like 100 more of them just hiding under the woodwork. We just got to find them. Oh goodness.
On bestsellers, promotional jobs based on sort of indirect snob appeal, carefully escorted by the trained seals of the critical fraternity.
The trained seals?
And lovingly tended and warded by certain much too powerful pressure groups whose business is selling books, although they would like to think they are fostering culture.
Oh my goodness, he just hates everybody, doesn't he? He's out to fight the critics, he's out to fight the publishers.
It just keeps going. Like, I kind of get Mike Grost's perspective now. Mike Grost said on Raymond Chandler that he's not a fan of Raymond Chandler as much because his work is just a bit grim and, you know, I get the feeling that this essay might give us a hint as to the rest of his collection.
I'm concerned. Well, maybe we should stay away from those, or maybe we should explore them
maybe
in
we should
detail.
Cover them.
Maybe we should just explore all of them and see how depressed he gets.
I'll have links on the podcast these articles, including Raymond Chandler was an asshole, which we won't get into today, but it does exist.
It's like the inverse of Van Dyne, because Van Dyne was like very critical and then he started writing saying, I can do better.
Yeah.
And Raymond Chandler has said, oh man, this is great writing detective novels. Boy, they all suck. Like, what?
I wonder who fulfills that purpose today. Who is the person in modern crime fiction who has grown to hate or grown to love from a position of hatred the genre? There's got to be one.
I feel like
it's a universal constant.
We have to find them. We have to find them and have them on the show.
Raymond Chandler started writing around when Van Dyne died.
Really? Oh my goodness.
It's like a ghost passed on
from person to person, from critic to critic. Oh my goodness. We've cracked the case, Flex. That was the real mystery.
That was the real mystery. So, you know, that is Raymond Chandler, Herds.
That's Raymond Chandler. I guess we should talk about the book at some point, but oh my goodness. I think
we could actually save the book for the next part of the show because this deserves Raymond Chandler's opinions.
Yeah.
Deserve
their
to
own
stand.
Segment. I agree. I agree with you. They deserve their time in the sun.
I was very tempted to replace our guest today with this. But I decided that this needed to go right out the gate. We needed to get straight in there.
No, I agree with you. Flex, you've made an impeccable decision. I can see why you picked this book. I can see why you picked this segment. I can see why we're in this room right now sharing No Crime in the Mountains.
But not really. We'll talk a
bit
more about Raymond Chandler.
No, we need to put him to bed.
Next week on the show. Just a few little details, because there's a few little interesting trivia tidbits out there. That is what you need to know before we discuss the
Excellent.
Next part of No Crime in the
Mountains. I'm ready.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds.
That was Raymond Chandler.
Raymond Chandler is an arsehole.
Wow.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour. And we are covering No Crime in the Mountains this week. It's our second episode on it. And today, we are joined in studio by Tess Connery.
Hello, it's so good to be back.
Oh my goodness.
Welcome.
To SER's former breakfast host, now writer for GOAT, long-term co-conspirator and true crime aficionado.
I told you that you wouldn't get rid of me.
I didn't think we would. I remember, Tess, the first time we met was just down the corridor from this studio, and we started a conversation about crime, and I endured a 30-minute rant about the Teacher's Pet podcast.
It's probably like,
and that was my introduction to you.
It was probably like 25 minutes.
Oh, I'm gonna go 35 if we're going to start making these arguments.
This is going to end up being an hour by the end of it, my goodness.
You are probably correct, yes.
But back when we started this show, we were discussing back and forth, like, oh my goodness, we have to get Tess on and talk about true crime versus crime fiction. And then you left the station.
I know, I did it just to throw a spanner in the works.
But we've dragged you back. And Tess, we are discussing perhaps the father of modern crime fiction. We have Agatha Christie, we have Emile Gaboria, all of these old farts writing their cozy murder mysteries. But then Raymond Chandler and his cohort brought in the modern crime fiction novel, the movie crime fiction novel, mm-hmm. the ones more engaged with the real world of crime, the gritty, the suspenseful, the ones that didn't really care about your goddamn puzzles. The bridging stories between the worlds of, you know, crime fiction and true crime, which is why we've decided to drag you on, Tess, and debate why you should be reading crime fiction instead.
Okay, all right. I'm down for a good debate.
We're going to actually fight you on the station right now.
We've got swords in the corner just in case things go awry.
Okay,
just in case.
I've got speed dial, security on speed dial. We're ready to go.
There you go.
So, Tess, what is it that first got you into true crime as a consumer of the genre?
I don't know if there was ever a particular point where a switch was flicked and all of a sudden I was really into it. But, you know, I watched a lot of Forensic Files as a kid and just it was one of those genres that really interested me. And I could never put a finger on why for the longest time. But the more I think about it, the more I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, the world is a horrific place. Mm. Oh. It's terrifying. It's awful. And I think it's a combination of morbid curiosity and also, I suppose, a feeling of arming yourself with knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, if you know what's out there, I don't know. That's my theory. There might be something deeply psychologically wrong with me that I haven't worked out yet, though.
Isn't that the case?
You and millions of others, allegedly.
Yeah.
Potentially. But no, it's just one of those things like, you know, my dad used to have the Crime Channel and I would just watch that until someone came out and went, oh my God, turn it off. You're scaring the house. So I've just always been really interested.
Yeah. I think one of the strange things for me with true crime, and this is, I guess, always going to be the main punching point for crime fiction back at its big brother to some extent, the idea that, you know, it's always fascinating having this unknown out there that when you're reading through true crime, you never know what's going to come. A lot of the time you're reading the cold cases and there's always like, you know, you're not going to get an answer there. And there's always this mystery of how far in does this go? How deep does it go? Do we have any idea what's going on at all? When crime fiction is like explicitly the opposite. And I find it interesting that like that's what appeals to me. I remember we had Catherine Lumby from Macquarie University on to talk about pretty well that earlier on this year and how, you know, a lot of people kind of have that morbid curiosity you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have that same morbid curiosity that some might, but I can appreciate a bit of true crime. I think that the thing that tantalizes a lot of people is that, like, there's the unknown. There's going to be a cliffhanger at the end of the story, and I'm not going to have answers. Especially compared to the crime fiction novels we're so used to with Knox and Van Dyne, with all these rules and strictures and criminals that are always tied up at the end in a neat little bow.
Yeah, I think one thing that was really interesting when you were first telling me about Teacher's Pet earlier this year is that you were going on about how, yeah, no, obviously this and obviously this and obviously this. And I'm like, but if it was obviously that, surely it would have, you know, this wouldn't be a cold case. You know, obviously there's something else going on with all of these cold cases. And, you know, the narrative that's told there is always really interesting. But I was wondering how you felt about the idea that, like, you know, through presenting it in Teacher's Pet and how they weave this narrative through it and other, you know, true crime podcasts. I remember we did a story last year on Breakfast about how the result of the Teacher's Pet podcast was that there probably wasn't going to be a fair trial for the people involved and the difficulties that, you know, that investigation causes because they're weaving that narrative, which is really just them storytelling over the top of real life and claiming it to be truth to some extent.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the major pitfalls of the genre as all of a sudden it's exploded. We are getting cases like that where, you know, it's being dragged in front of the media and, you know, fair trials are, you know, necessarily being affected. I think it is a pretty concerning thing. Trying to solve some of these things, that's when you can get a couple of major plot holes.
I think there's a big difference between trying to catalog that kind of subjective experience of the family and the victims compared to trying to assert, you know, this is the objective facts. This is how it happened. This is the truth. And I think we sometimes see these pitfalls as well when creating media around this, creating movies or novels or whatever about, you know, true crime. It's why we always have that little tag, maybe inspired or may, you know, replicate real events, but it's definitely not, it's not that, it's not real, guys, like, don't worry about it, because you can fall into that pitfall of people saying, ah, you see, this you know, P.T. Barnum was really a really great guy, we love him so much, just as a wild example there, when he wasn't.
And you get, like, I'm not doing a very good job at advocating for my side here.
It's all right.
That's right. We're here to rip you down.
Debate was a strong word for really just having fun.
I'm not doing a very good job debating here. But that's another thing as well, is that you with crime fiction, you can be obsessed with whoever you want. If it's the murderer, I'm going to judge you. But, you know, fair play.
That's not the fun, though.
With true crime, you get really scary crap. Like those people who write love notes to Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
That's something that crime fiction does take away, which I can appreciate.
Yeah. I mean, when you could step back from reality and not have people objectifying and idolizing real murderers.
Yeah.
That's a plus.
It's not great. It's not great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite stories from this year was the Benson murder case, which was by S.S. Van Dyne, and we covered it on the show. It was based off a real-life crime, and still to this day, unsolved murder in a locked room in a New York apartment of, I believe, Joseph Elwell. And the novel basically took that premise and weaved this whole narrative around it. And obviously, you know, the speculation in the newspapers at the time was used to kind of help weave this narrative and all of the weird things people thought was happening. And, you know, this posh upperclassman coming in and saying, well, no, of course, the psychology of the matter. And I think that there definitely is, you know, that whole element of truth being stranger than fiction, and then taking those elements and weaving them into a narrative is a really compelling way to tell stories. But we kind of went through this problematic period over the last couple of years where true crime started to do that and take itself too seriously.
Very much so.
And it's good, as you say, to see that we're coming out the other side of that to some extent, because obviously there's still a very human story to be told. Mm. I remember we were speaking a few episodes ago with author A.B. Patterson, whose books, by the way, if you comment on a picture of them on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, you could win yourself some copies.
Hey.
At Flicks and Hurts.
Yeah, there we go. Smooth plug. But basically, he was talking about, as a former police officer, how some of the things he'd encountered, if you told him and if you told us that they were real stories, you wouldn't believe them. Like an underground mirrored basement full of torture implements.
What? No.
Like,
yeah.
It happened. I was reading it on the man's bio on his website, and I was like, oh, wow, that's a really interesting excerpt from his... That's not from the novel?
Yeah. Oh, my God. This is what I mean. It's that morbid curiosity of like, oh, my God, not only can this happen, but it could happen down the street from me.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Jesus. And then you scream forever.
Yeah, it's especially one of these things when you look at like really old cases and how people have moved around the country, how all of these people will have stories of like how they lived near this one criminal or how this happened near them. You know, it's in every neighborhood. I have one in my street, which I won't say for the sake of not giving my home address out. But
it's terrifying. All right, fair enough.
Point being, we all have those personal touchstones to crime.
You're just saying Flex has a dark past. Excellent. Good to know. Look, I don't have a dog pass.
Are you accusing me of the crime?
This is a very suspicious claim.
Not on air, I wouldn't.
Something happened on my street.
Taps nose.
Chin stroke.
Where did this white cat and apple come from?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh, so evil.
Hard agree.
So basically, today's conclusion is that Tess Connery doesn't actually love crime fiction as much as her bio has said for the past 2 years.
Tess Connery does love crime fiction, but no, true crime, dear Lord. Tess Connery does love true crime podcasts and listening to it, but also A, is not a very good debater, and B, recognizes that there are a lot of problems with it.
Oh, there you go.
And that's the kind of self-awareness that we need. That's the kind of self-awareness we pride ourselves on
in the true crime sphere. Mm-hmm.
Tess, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on Breakfast here at 2SER for the past 2 years. We will miss you dearly, even though it's now been however many weeks since you've left.
It took me two weeks to get back onto this station.
I know.
Don't question it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
We'll miss you. See you around. We'll be back with No Crime in the Mountains in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour. And after bullying Raymond Chandler and having a lovely discussion with our guest, it's time to actually talk about this week's book.
Oh, do we have
to? We are discussing No Crime in the Mountains by Raymond Chandler, chapters 5 to 9. Herds, you are the blind man, and you're on the clock.
It's
true. You've got to both describe and solve this book in 10 minutes.
So, like, again, we have the same kind of structure we had last time, where each chapter is its own little scene, which I appreciate. We chase some ladies around a cabin. We chat with a sheriff. We have a look at a corpse. We interrogate a poor old, probably widowed woman. And then we have a little car chase. And that's exactly what we've done for the last 5 chapters. I'm done.
All right.
How quick was that? Was that 20 seconds?
Yeah, I mean, it was
we're done.
Was
we can leave
short.
Now.
Yeah, I guess we just play music until the show's done.
But yeah, like, I mean, it was pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Normally in this part of the show, I try to solve everything, but I feel like they've kind of solved it for us. I could be wrong. No confirming or denying, but like, things seem pretty well laid out.
If
that, like, Ludus is the mastermind and, like, Ms. Lacey is in on it, and her husband's dead. Like, I trust that.
If you've read up to chapter 9 along with this, you will know that they pretty well explain the plot in chapter 9. And here you are telling me that you're just going to believe that I've just given you the answer?
You've just given me the answer what the book has, because that's not its priority. That is the feeling that I'm getting. I'm not saying there are no twists and turns in the story that we can uncover, but I don't think this is a murder mystery in the traditional sense. As we said, Raymond Chandler, his priorities are different. I don't think that his priority is, like, figuring out who the killer is. I think that Ludus is, like, the mastermind. That Japanese gunman that we apparently have, alongside our German mob people. Oh, this is some World War nonsense. This is some, like, Japs and Germans coming over from the motherland and stirring crap in the US. That's what this is. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't know that it really matters that much, because we haven't been presented with, like, a closed room and, like, who could own the gun that killed the person. Like, if I'm going to lock in anything particularly interesting, it's that assertion about, like, there's Germans and Japanese. It's probably some, like, old gold nonsense. Look, if there's Nazi gold in this, I wouldn't be surprised. But, like, I feel like it's just not Raymond's priority. It's a short story after all. We're here to enjoy this, like, crime drama and this, like, car chase through the mountains. We're not here to, like, uncover the specifics. I don't know. That's just the vibe I'm getting.
Yeah.
There's probably, like, the specifics of the scheme of, like, where the counterfeit bills are going, but it seems like Mr. Webber's has just overstepped his boundaries with handing out money.
The question that I have, is that, you know, all of this is very straightforward, and as you say, the novel does kind of break down its own questions almost immediately after
it
asking
does.
Them.
It does.
But then, how does this fulfill Raymond Chandler's rule? The detective novel must baffle a reasonably intelligent reader. Is a reasonably intelligent person to Raymond Chandler not where we would consider it? Is, in fact, the reason Raymond Chandler was so bitter and cold because he grew up, you know, around people who could barely put numbers together?
Lumpkins, perhaps? Yeah. I mean, it's not a terrible question, to be fair. I think that lies in kind of the more background details of, like, what is the specific scheme of the criminals? I feel like that's more, like, the thing that was going to baffle us. Like, I still am not entirely sure, like, why are they here? What are they using the money for? Is it to, like, fund Nazism? Is that what's going on? Mm-hmm. Like, I can't pin that down precisely.
I mean, I think pinning it on the war is maybe a good idea. This did come out the same year as Pearl Harbor.
Oh, well, there you go.
So who knows? Maybe that'll come back around. I mean, I barely remember what my theory was last week. I've got to be entirely honest.
That's all right.
So I can't really say how true it was or not. It was probably completely made up.
That's fine.
But I do like that this novel has kind of presented a different challenge where You know, I won't say why I chose to stop where I did, but I do think that the way that it presents these clues, actually kind of early in the book, like,
sure,
it feels like this explanation is coming, you know, with a third of the book left. So what do we do with the remaining third of the book?
We chase them down.
Yeah.
We chase down the characters and we see if we can catch them in their, like, secret, you know, tripartite packed base under the, not the hotel, the lodge that Luders runs, right? Because I think that's where it's actually been run out of, now that I think about it. That makes more sense at this point in the story than the hotel itself. But anyway, I definitely think that the last third of the story is going to be focused on, like, here's the, like, convoluted plan of the Nazi foreign spies or whatever. And it's going to, we're going to focus on that. We're going to focus on, like, the background of the plot rather than the actual murder, because I think in the grand scheme of things, the death of Lacey is really just stiffing a witness. Yeah. Like, that's pretty standard stuff for a crime novel about, you know, organized crime. Not a personal crime so much, but organized crime, just like offing someone because they know too much. I mean, that's what happened to Weber. That's what happened, I think, to Mr. Lacey. And that's probably what may very well happen to Mrs. Lacey.
Who knows? We'll probably have more death before the end of the novel. Maybe just everyone ends up dead.
I'd be okay with that, you know?
But, you know, no crime in the mountains at all. Hardly.
Hardly any crime at all, I would say, except for an organized crime ring, it sounds like. Apart from that, yeah. Look, I just hope that Gertrude and Anna got out. They were able to Achtung their way out of there.
Yeah.
Good grief. I thought they would be giving more coy about the nationalities thing, but they have just gone full swing about that, which no. I love. A lot of novels, a lot of stories that have been told now are, you know, fantasy or sci-fi. Mm. They use as metaphor rather than as explicit, you know, the here are the Nazis and here's the Americans fighting the Nazis, right?
Not to say that that wasn't done before as well, but sure. I think that in a more globalized context, it makes more sense to kind of have these broader strokes. One of the things about the Caves of Steel is that the us versus them conflict was coming from a man who was, you know, associated with both sides. He was a Russian living in America.
For sure, yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, this all kind of comes back to, you know, a story must be credibly motivated. It's not just the motives of the criminals in the story. It's also that if it's a made-up thing that means nothing to you, it probably will feel that way.
I was going to say, the final lesson there, must be honest with the reader, I think is very prevalent in this novel. Especially if we are, if I am claiming that this solution, as it were, that's being presented in chapter 9, more or less, is the truth.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty plausible, given his 10th, you know, his 10th law there. Unless there's some kind of sudden twist that's about to happen, which is possible, but I feel like we've already reached the climax.
Yeah.
We're kind of barreling towards it right now. We've already teamed up with the law. We're heading on after the criminal. It's just a matter of, you know, lifting up the lid of the box and seeing what's inside.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think that that's why this story is so strong paired with these 10 rules, because you can see each of them unfolding in a way that really embodies a perspective on the rules, but also demonstrates how flexible you can be.
Sure.
You know, as with the example I said there, that it's credibly motivated in that there's a credible motive for the criminal, but also that the position that Raymond Chandler's in, his, you know, distastes in the crime fiction genre kind of coming through in the ways that it's very atypical.
Sure.
I really think that it's a strong example of Chandler's work. And you can see Chandler in this text. So Herds?
Flex.
You're just agreeing with the story? That's your final pick?
I mean, more or less. Like, I've added some extra bits and pieces about how there's, like, this World War II nonsense going on. I think that Mr. Lacey is dead. I don't know. I mean, is there anything more specific you want me to answer? Like,
No.
Like, I've been told to just solve the story, but I feel like I've already pinned down, like, I think that the Japanese government killed Mr. Lacey because this whole mob boss business, it's like foreign affairs nonsense, whatever this is.
Now the question
is,
Weber,
like, messed up when he put the counterfeit bills in the shoe.
The question is, Hertz, before we end today's show, if this is the solution, was it fair before you got here?
Yeah, I think it's pretty fair so far. I just think that he's given the answer, so to speak, even if we haven't seen it in black and white writing. He's giving you some accurate detective reasoning, like, a little bit earlier than we would have expected in the story. But I think it's pretty fair.
If it is, in fact, the truth, Herds, we might have to find something else to discuss at the end of next week's show.
Maybe we will. It's not my job.
Maybe
look forward
we
to
will.
A flex.
This has been Death of the Reader for this week. We will be discussing the final chapters from chapter 10 to the end of Raymond Chandler's No Crime in the Mountains. Herds,
awesome.
Good luck. May
Thank
the fates
you.
Carry you.
Thank you, Flex. I will be carried to the mountain, the top of the mountain, where I will stand and hopefully remain standing and not be pushed off at the end by a Japanese gunman.
Don't forget, check out our social pages at Flex and Herds, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We have a competition running there where you can win yourself a modern noir novel by our guest Andrew B. Patterson. Don't forget to drop a comment on the picture of the books if you want a chance to win that. Thank you very much for listening.